today we started off the show with Amanda being a pedantic fuckwit and mentioning that the title of the book does not actually have a defining article, and Tori having a moment of, oh shit, there's not a defining article.
Be quick. Well, crap, now I gotta go fix the website. Not that we've even published anything on the website. I've just like preformed the thing. So,
and I honestly don't think that anyone would care. Hi, we're reading Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka.
The best part is this is the book that I picked for my birthday month.
This is the book that Tori chose for her birthday of her own volition. I did not prod her into this. This was her decision. Infer what you will about mental states. That this was the book she chose for fun.
I realized recently that I am dead inside.
I mean, I feel like I'm not anymore, but it's because like I'm 1950s housewife zooted. Prozac is great. Prozac is phenomenal.
Yeah, my medication is no longer working, I think is the issue. So
yeah,
it's been 3 years, so it's about time for it to cease working.
Yeah, I'm in the opposite boat where I'm back on antidepressants after a few months, and I feel great.
Which is good. You deserve to feel great.
Thank you. So, as mentioned, we're reading Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, a very sad book, a sad beige book for sad beige authors. It's sad and gray outside. It's cold, it's wet, it's gray.
Seasonal depression is a bitch.
It's not seasonal depression if you're depressed the other season, Tori.
But it's festive now. There's lights.
Like if it's like that meme I sent you, and it's like the Grim Reaper at the beach. Like, now I have a tropical depression.
Yes.
All right. Before we get started, Tori, would you like to tell the audience about the delicious culinary concoction that I got to tell you about earlier in this week?
Wait. Oh, my God. No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Now I'm having traumatic flashbacks. So we had a discussion. You know, there's the whole concept of there's no such thing as white culture. Unfortunately, there is such a thing as white culture, but we like to pretend it doesn't exist. Yes. There is a thing called a candle salad, which I had never heard of, but Amanda knew very, very well. It involves a single leaf of lettuce.
Yes.
A ring of pineapple, like the ones you get out of the can.
Yes.
You then peel a banana, stick it in the center, which already I was like, I'm done. I'm done here. That sounds like something you'd make for the tiki orgy.
Nope. It gets better.
You top it with a maraschino cherry and then whipped cream, which can drip down the sides to be candle wax. That is not a candle. That is a penis, Deborah.
Yeah. So you can either do whipped cream and a cherry on top. I've seen some recipes that will do mayonnaise or sour cream.
Why? Why?
These are your people, Victoria. I should be asking you, am I an anthropologist of white culture? Why do I know more about this than you do?
Because my family isn't from the Midwest.
Elaborate for me. The candle salad is not Midwestern.
Where the fuck is it from, hell?
I mean, yes. But it's not Midwestern. Like, it wasn't very popular. Like, just, like, 50s housewifey thing.
Yeah, but it's so aspic.
It was very, very popular from the 1920s to the 1960s. And it can include lettuce, pineapple, banana, and cherry with either mayonnaise, whipped cream, or cottage cheese. Now, I've seen sour cream. Cottage cheese sounds literally like the worst.
How do you eat it?
Well, you tie your hair back.
You get a good old-fashioned scrunchie.
Yeah, you get a black scrunchie that was on your wrist because you knew it was going to be that kind of night.
Again, I feel like most of this food, especially things that involve Jell-O and aspic and stuff like that from the 60s, were like, what is the weirdest thing we can have on this table at our orgy?
And the thing is like, these were so, like, sexually repressed, like, parts of American history that it's, like, how did you look at this? And like, there's a part of me that, because it kind of reminds me of like kid food. We're like, oh, it's food for children. Like a lot of like 50s and like 50s and 60s salads are like kid food. It's like, oh, we're trying to get kids to eat vegetables and stuff like that. So I can see how, like, to the innocent mind of a child, oh yeah, this is a candle. The cherry is the flame. The mayonnaise or the sour cream is, or the whipped cream is the wax. The bananas, is, like when you eat like ants on a log, it's fucking celery, peanut butter, and like if it's kid food, sure. But I have no idea how my mom is making this and not just like, I'm serving my child a dick. Because there's no other way to approach it. I don't know how else. And yeah, like, how do you eat it? Do you just knock it over and then use a fork and a knife? I mean, is this a bananas hollandaise scenario?
Bananas hollandaise? I'm afraid to ask. But
you take a banana and you wrap it in ham and sometimes cheese, and then you cover it in a hollandaise and you bake it.
Why?
Why do I know more about your culture than you do?
I don't know.
Yeah, so it's hot banana and ham.
Hot ham and banana.
Hot ham banana, yes. So that was what Victoria got to learn about white culture. We're running away from the book because it's very, very sad. So as far as what we're eating and drinking, I actually, so Vecherovka is like the, I think it's like the national liqueur of Czechoslovakia, is it not?
Well, I guess it would be the Czech Republic now.
Sure, sorry. Czech Republic, forgive me. See, we were talking about the 1950s and 1960s. I went back in time. Like, ah, oh, yes, I am.
You were like, we went back in time to when the Czechs and the Slovaks decided to form Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, okay, Czech Republic. And it's, you know what? I made it into a mule with ginger beer. It's not bad. I like it more than I like Jaeger, but that's not a high bar to jump over because I dislike the Jaeger.
My sister, for her 21st birthday, went out, had a bunch of Jaeger, came home, threw up on the stairs, managed to crawl her way into bed. And the next morning, my mom came downstairs and said, did you have fun last night? We got her a bottle of Jaeger for her birthday. She immediately gagged upon opening it. That's a family story.
My aunt is like in her 60s and she like just recently started drinking Jaeger. And she's like, Amanda, is there this thing called Jaegermeister? It's like, yeah, it's a mistake. Don't do that.
I feel okay. Like everybody goes through a phase where they have like either Rumpelmans or Goldschlager or Jaeger. It's something in their like early life, or in your aunt's case, like late in life.
Late in life.
Where they're like, I just want to feel something.
So I'm sorry. I don't mean to derail. I have to bring back the candle salad, because under variations includes using strawberry yogurt.
What the fuck?
And alfalfa sprouts.
It just gets worse. It becomes like an almond mom thing.
Right, so we've turned this objectively terrible food. Just this objectively terrible food. Oh, I'm sending Tori a picture because she has to include it on the website of this horrible candle salad. Look at this candle salad. This was made by socialites. This was a fancy... This, if you saw this at a gathering, this was a fancy appetizer. I'm pretty sure if I went to a party and I got served this, I would assume that this is an eyes wide shut scenario.
See, this is what's making me wonder if, like, in the future, generations later are going to look at those TikTok videos of people making the butter candle.
Yes.
And just be like, what the fuck were you people on about?
I mean, yeah, I don't.
I'm using the F word a lot this podcast.
Yeah, I don't have. The thing is that, like, I know about this stuff. But yeah, like, I don't have answers for you. All right. Do you want a short story long before? Because we could honestly have a whole other podcast about horrible vintage food.
I mean, maybe we should. All right. Short story. It'll just be me being like, why?
Yes.
Short story long. I need you to know that, like the bell jar, I laugh through this entire book because I'm a horrible person and I'm dead inside.
Well, and we're going to talk about that because I feel like that's something that a lot of people don't realize about Kafka's work. But is we're going to, okay, we're putting a pin in that. We're going to come back to that.
So traveling salesman Gregor Samsa wakes up one morning to discover that he is a large insect. Mm-hmm. His room looks totally normal, so he assumes that maybe he's dealing with stuff, so he just decides to go back to sleep and hopes it takes care of itself. Unfortunately, he tries to roll over, and he realizes he can't do that because he's stuck on this big new bug back. Yeah. He goes to scratch an itch, and he finds out he has a bunch of new, odd, skinny little legs. Like, oh... This is fun. He freaks out because he sees his clock and he realizes he's late for work. Keeping in mind, not freaking out about the hands, the new weird bug
appendages, nothing like that. Yeah.
He's late for work. He's like, my whole family relies on me. I hate my job so much. I would quit. But if I quit, my family is screwed. His mom knocks on the door. Gregor goes to answer it and he figures out that his voice has changed. So now it's just a bunch of squeaks. He's gotten into the habit of locking all the doors because he travels, and so he spends a lot of time in boarding houses. Mm-hmm. And his family's like, I guess he's just sick. He tries to get out of bed. He can't move enough to turn over at first. And then, being the weirdest office manager ever, his office manager shows up at the house to figure out where the hell Gregor is, since he's never missed a day of work. Yeah. And what the hell? In a panic, Gregor finally rolls himself off the bed and tries to call out that he's going to the door, but it's just a bunch more squeaks. And so his boss starts berating him through the door and telling him all this stuff about how there's going to be consequences if he doesn't show up to work. Keep in mind, he's never missed a day of work, and keeps acting
like he's a giant bug.
Yeah. And he's like, your work hasn't been satisfactory lately. Mr. Micromanage, the man is a bug. Anyway, Gregor tries to defend himself verbally, but again, it just comes out as a bunch of squeaks. He tries to open the door with his mouth since his hands are gone and gets it to work. He ends up hurting the top of his mouth. His boss takes one look at the bug creature and flees. Gregor's dad drives Gregor back into the room with his cane and a rolled up newspaper. And our bug friend hurts himself when he's getting back through the door. His dad slams the door, and Gregor goes to sleep thanks to the exhaustion. Thank you. It's the trauma.
It is.
When he wakes up, he sees someone has left him bread and milk. He realizes he no longer likes milk, which is weird because it used to be one of his favorite things. I wrote in parentheses, clearly a psycho, to which Amanda replied,
I like milk. I drink milk.
I cannot stand milk.
And like, I realized, like, not like in like a weird Homelander way. Like, I like milk.
I don't know the reference and I don't want to.
You do not. Do not.
No. I think I watched 2 episodes of The Boys and was like, this is not for me. It's for other people, but it's not for me.
It's not for me. I don't like The Boys or Invincible. Continue.
Okay. So Gregor ends up hiding under the couch and listens to the sounds of the apartment. In the morning, he sees his sister Greta come into the room to take away the milk and the bread. She sees he hasn't touched it, so she leaves him a bunch of rotted food, which he devours. He's like, this is freaking great. They start to settle him into a routine where Greta comes in to feed him. He hides under the couch, which I accidentally typed he horses under the couch. And then she cleans up the room. So Gregor spends all of his time listening to his family talk about life. As he's no longer bringing in money, they are financially strapped. Gregor hears his mom saying she wants to visit him, but Greta and his dad are like, it's going to be too much for you. Don't go into that room, please. Gregor starts to get used to his new body, starts to climb the walls for fun. I mean, like, how many times have we joked that we're about ready to climb the walls? Greta's like, hey, we're going to get rid of some of this furniture so you have more space to roam. And she and his mom start to take out the furniture, but Gregor freaks out about it. He tries to save this picture he has on the wall of a woman wearing a fur hat, scarf, and fur muff that he cut out of a magazine. So he doesn't even have a picture of, like, somebody who's important to him. He has a picture from a magazine. This sort of is, like, to me, it kind of feels like when you have a poster in your room that your parents don't like or your guardians don't like, and they keep threatening to take it out if they clean your room.
Yes.
Gregor's mom sees Gregor crawling the walls and promptly passes out. Greta calls after Gregor, which is the first time since he's changed that anyone has actually talked to him directly. Mm-hmm. He runs into the kitchen. His dad is now employed again. He returns home. His dad's an asshole. He doesn't understand what's happening. So he starts chucking apples at Gregor, and one gets lodged in Gregor's back, leaving him with a major injury. The apple remains in the wound to rot. What a symbol. Gregor's family starts to keep the bug boy's bedroom door open for a few hours each night so he can observe them and listen to them talk. His family is starting to break down because of their poverty. Even Greta seems to be resenting her brother. Her previous care for him turns into the minimalist of effort. They hire a really cheap cleaning lady who tolerates Gregor and talks to him sometimes, but they also use his room as storage. His family takes in three boarders, moving the extra furniture into Gregor's room because the boarders bring their own stuff. And Gregor basically just kind of stops eating entirely. He doesn't really want the rotted food anymore. He doesn't really want to eat anything. So he just keeps hearing his family talk about how they'd move someplace cheaper, but they can't figure out how to move Gregor, and they bitch about it. One night, the cleaning lady leaves Gregor's door open. The boarders are hanging out in the living room and ask Greta to play violin for them. Gregor creeps out to listen, and the boarders start to get bored and annoyed by the violin, but Gregor is completely transfixed by his sister's playing. One of the boarders sees Gregor and freaks out because there is a large bug in the house. Gregor's dad tries to push the boarders back into their rooms, but they say, you know what? Fuck this. We're moving out. We're not paying rent because this house is disgusting. Greta tells her parents they have to get rid of Gregor. Their father agrees and says he wishes that Gregor would just leave on his own. Gregor understands what they're saying. He moves back into his room, lays down, and dies. They are super relieved when Gregor is dead. His dad kicks out the boarders. The cleaning lady disposes of Gregor's body, and the family decides to take a trolley ride to the country. They talk about how living so sparsely has left them some money, and they decide to move to a better apartment. Greta is evidently getting her strength back, and her parents talk about how she's so beautiful now, and they should find her a husband.
All I can say is that I'm really, really glad that I'm back on Prozac, because I feel like if I read this in my original mental state, I would be like Nietzsche was with the horse that fell, where it was just like, I understand you, I'm so sad. So I'm glad that I'm pretty zooted right now, and I can't feel this too deeply, but this is really sad.
Every time you say zooted, I'm like...
There's not a better word for it outside of zooted.
1950s housewife zooted. I love that.
I am 1950s housewife zooted. Like, I am one step below ice pick lobotomy, and so far it feels pretty good. Okay, so we have a lot of themes in here, but we also have a clarification. One, the book says that Gregor is a large bug. And I know from context that he's akin to a beetle or a bed bug. What the fuck does the cleaning lady do with his body?
That is an excellent question. Part of me is like, what, does she just like throw it in the dump? And my brain is like getting this like Barnum and Bailey kind of thing of, or actually just P.T. Barnum going through the trash and being like, great German bed bug.
Yeah, P.T. Barnum having the best fucking day of his life. Did you watch that very sad documentary about Jumbo yet?
No, I haven't, because it's, I was in a mood, sad. And I was like, if I watch this, it's going to hurt me.
Yeah, it's going to hurt you. And David Attenborough just makes it all the worse. I didn't really know about Jumbo, but apparently he was an alcoholic, and I didn't know you could have an alcoholic elephant.
There was one in Corsicana that trampled someone to death.
I do know about that story.
A long time ago. But yeah, I'm like,
it's one of the most famous things to happen in Corsicana, which should tell you everything you need to know about Corsicana. Corsicana, also where I had my first ghost experience.
Corsicana, also where they have like the world's most famous fruitcake that doesn't taste like ass.
Corsicana, tourism department, pay us. You said two nice things about your hell swamp.
Yeah, we mentioned an elephant, but you can ignore that part.
Yeah, we've mentioned like three nice things about your hell land. Pay us. So we need to talk about the obvious theme, which is alienation, and how a lot of alienation is both internal but also determined by external factors. A lot of it is, you know, fitting into society and looking a certain way, but a lot of it also is how you feel. Gregor already had those feelings inside of him, and it was only made worse when he became a giant bug. So, I mean, not to say that he could have, like, girl-bossed his way through being a giant bug.
Well, even the very first sentence is, when Gregor Samso awoke from troubling dreams. So it's not like he just woke up and went, oh my, I'm a bug, everything's terrible. I mean, right. What were his chief thoughts? He saw these little tiny legs and he's like, whatever. Oh God, I'm late for work. Like,
right. So like that was already in him and already a part of him. Which I think dovetails us quite nicely into Othering, is that as soon as he became, I mean, he was already kind of like not great as far as his family was concerned. But then when he became something else, it was really, really easy to like cast him aside. I mean, it's very like the obvious comparison. Oh my God, what was that one movie where the dude becomes that weird bug alien that everyone keeps? District 9.
Oh. Huh?
Is it District 9?
Yes, it is District 9.
Yeah. So, like, is that
really cool South African dude?
Yeah. So, like, you know, the dude becomes a weird bug alien. Everyone's like, ah, he's different. So, like, it's usually also in text, it's also a metaphor for how you feel. Because, again, a lot of that feeling starts inside. And then books, because they're trying to do some theming, will take what you feel inside and make it outside.
What's interesting too, and Amanda and I talked about this offline, there are so many different readings of this book that you can have.
There are.
Based on the concept of othering and alienation.
Absolutely. Like there are so many different readings that you can have, and we can actually go ahead and move those up a little bit and outline. So like one of the obvious ones that we both discuss is almost like a chronic illness reading.
Yes.
So like both of us have been open about being chronically ill. There have definitely been days that I have woken up and, you know, my joints hurt, you know, my uterus goes in the wrong direction, so I get really, really bad cramps. And there are sometimes that I just feel so disconnected and gross from my body that, yeah, I've definitely had times where I feel like a giant bug. I mean, it's not written in here, but there is definitely room to talk about the mental illness read that definitely being depressed and anxious. I have 100% felt like this gross, horrible creature that isn't human and isn't deserving of love. And again, there's always, yes.
Kafka was genuinely affected by severe anxiety. He had a severe anxiety disorder.
Yes.
So that reading is not off base at all.
No. Not in the least. There's also, you know, this really, really interesting, almost queer reading to it, that when you have, you know, body dysmorphia and stuff like that, you do feel so like gross and out of place. And again, that alienation and othering. Which means that we get to talk about my favorite thing, which is gender performance. So one of the things that defines Gregor, because he lives in a capitalist patriarchal society, is that as a man, he contributes to do man things. And when he's a bug, he can't do that. And that is crippling to him because all he knows is how to be a man and do man things. Because remember, gender is all about performance. What one society's idea of what masculine and feminine is to other society, completely inverse. It's one of the reasons why I find a lot of the discussions around like being gender non-binary or gender non-conforming or even trans to be so just backward sometimes. Because it's like, one, you're assuming these people haven't always existed. They have. Culturally, they have. There's always been people that are like this. And then two, it's you're basing this on a very narrow lens of what you think gender means right now, or a very false idea of what you thought gender meant hundreds of years ago. Insert my favorite thing, which is especially when there's a very, very certain brand of cishet white dude that loves talking about how masculine and strong the Greco-Romans were. Exactly. There's a very certain subsect of like cishet white dude that loves to be like, oh, we need to go back to like Sparta. It's like Spartans who are fucking little boys and, you know, running around and doing a lot of genocide and murder. We need to go back to that. We need to That's what we need to go back to? Okay. Cool.
Well, then we have these concept twos, like these color concepts now, where we're very much like, oh, blue is for boys and pink is for girls. And it was the exact opposite, like 100 years ago. Pink was considered to be the more virile color. And so, like, you'll be reading stuff and it's like, oh, yeah. And, you know, we want to get the most masculine color possible. So we got him a dress in pink. And it's like all of these pictures of catechisms and stuff with these little boys in fucking dresses. High heels were originally for men, not for women. Like, it's culture changes over time. And it can completely flip itself on its head. And so that's why it's so funny to me that we're so insecure as a people, at least in the United States. I mean, in a lot of other places too, where there's just this concept of like, oh, no, I can't be seen as feminine because if I'm seen as feminine, then I'm somehow inherently weak. And it's like, that's never actually been the case.
Absolutely. All right. So let's go back up to abuse, leaving behind visible scars and invisible scars. So like one of the scenes that really did bother me was like the rotting apple thing, because that's just sad. Like, that's just really sad. And like the depiction of it's gross. And it's like, but also I think it speaks to, so like I'm back on like my mental health journey. Like I'm back in therapy. I'm back on medication. And like, one of the things that it kind of made me remember is like, what do you have to do to let something rot like that? That like he didn't, you know, wash himself or do anything like that. And like, I'm not like victim blaming Gregor, like that's not what I'm doing, but like, yeah, sometimes when you're that depressed, when you're that sad, you don't do things like that, and it only makes those things worse. Like, it only exacerbates those things. And like, that was just such like a deeply sad scene. And like, knowing about Kafka's life where he deeply wanted his father's love and he never got it, was just like, oh, this sucks.
Yeah, and a lot of that too is like the concept of like the festering wound. In this case, it's physical, but it's also emotional, because it's like this person who's supposed to be your protector, this person who's supposed to guide you through life, is the one chucking the blow at you.
Right. And it's just, that's such a visceral thing. But like, if you've been in an abusive household or you have known someone who's been through abuse, sometimes abuse does not look like what you think it looks like and can be like that outlandish. For me, my aunt pushed me down a staircase once. And like, this is how deep abuse goes. Her sister, my other aunt, she'll always interject, "You stopped at the landing." Like, that erases the getting pushed down a staircase. That I didn't fall all the way down the stairs. I stopped the landing. The landing stopped me. Therefore, it invalidates what happened. And, like, when you have abuse normalized for you, it leads to stuff like that. Where, like, yeah, you do just let a wound fester. Because you are just so beaten down emotionally and physically that you can't even think of a solution to better yourself.
And you internalize it. You think that this is normal. This is something I deserve, even if you clearly don't.
Right.
You start to believe that, you know, that you must have done something wrong to deserve this type of treatment.
Absolutely. And it's sad. Like, it was a really, really sad part of the book to go through. Body horror. So one thing about this that it doesn't give you... It almost feels weird calling a body horror, because usually body horror is all about like the lurid details about like limbs stretching and bones snapping and, you know, appendages. Like, usually body horror is all about details. We get no details. Just one day he's a bug. Mm-hmm. One day he's a bug. Deal with it. But there's still like this utterly horrifying aspect of it that like you are so out of control that this could happen to you. And there's a really, really deep chronic illness read in there. There's probably a pretty deep like puberty gender read in there. I mean, obviously there's the mental health read in there. But then also how we treat people, not just with chronic like physical illness, but chronic mental illness as well. because we see how Gregor's family treats him when he can't be productive, when he can't produce, when he can't bring home the bacon. And if you grew up with mental illness, and unless your family was super supportive, you've probably experienced this, that your family was not as kind to you when you couldn't sit down and, you know, sit and hang out with a family because you were too tired, when you didn't work or when you tried to miss school. I mean, again, I was raised Black and hyper-competent, so that wasn't an option for me. But like, in the times that I have been so stressed out that I just physically can't, that has been really hard for my family to understand. And they've never, you know, thrown apples at me, but, you know, it's sad. It's really sad.
I do get the feeling too that Gregor's father was a lot less physically abusive and a lot less prone to speaking to his son in certain ways when he was the only one bringing money in the house. Like, there are descriptions of the dad just kind of sitting on the couch and being like, I can't do anything. I have to sit in my chair. You know, I was injured at work. I can't do anything. And his son, you know, working himself basically to death to try and bring money into the house. And I mean, we're not talking minimalist either. There is, when the book starts, there is a housekeeper. There are people who are a pretty decent housekeeper. And then they make a very big point of, well, we had to hire somebody who was, you know, less competent and cheaper. And it's just this constant barrage too of like, oh, well, he can't do anything. He's no longer of any value to us. That even if they don't say it outright, it's hinted at over and over again. Although they get pretty blatant about it towards the end where it's like, well, we could do a bunch of stuff if he just shoved off this mortal coil.
Yeah, like if he just vanished, we would be able to get a lot of things done. If he just shuffled off this mortal coil, yeah, we could get a lot done. And I know that, like, I know if you grew up in a household where you were mentally ill, and oftentimes your family was also mentally ill, but in a different flavor, you got a lot of that. Maybe not always to that extent, but like, yeah. So like I've mentioned, my aunts, all of them are on the spectrum of mental illness, but because mine manifested in a way that was different to them, they had a really, really hard time sometimes understanding what I was going through. So even if we were all in theory on the same boat and we all should have solidarity, because mine didn't manifest the way that theirs did, they really like just did not understand. And especially at the time, did not try very hard to understand me. We have to talk about the fact that, especially Western society, does not like bugs, and bugs are gross. I got to see a really, really cool video by Emily Grassley, who does this series called The Brain Scoop, which is a taxidermy thing, talking about how especially like a lot of Eastern cultures have a lot of reverence for bugs and think that they're super, super cool. We, in most parts of the West, do not, and find them gross and horrible, including me. I do not like bugs. They scare me. So the idea of becoming a giant bug is literally my worst case scenario for me. I do not like them. They freak me out, especially the ones that can fly. Do not like them. I don't know why in the South roaches have wings. I don't know why any deity decided they need the ability to fly.
I love my husband a few years ago, you had had, this is many apartments back, you had had an issue. And just so everybody is aware, in Texas, you can have the cleanest house possible. You can bleach your counters 3 times a day and still end up with cockroaches, either because of your neighbors or just because they live in the garage. Like, it is not a moral failing. It just happened. Yeah, and I remember getting this panicked series of text messages of, oh my God, what the fuck is this? And why is it in my sink? And my husband being like, that's nothing but a palmetto bug. And me being like, what? Why are you so comfortable with this? He's like, I grew up in Georgia.
Right. Like, that's a thing that we have and you deal with it. And you're right. Like, it's not a class thing. Like, they are everywhere. They're literally everywhere. San Antonio is actually one of the roachiest cities in America.
Yeah, they're all over the garage. It's disgusting.
But in the West, we view bugs as gross. You know, we see them, you know, as detritus eaters. We associate them with putrefaction and decay. River!
Sorry, she was getting ready to do her like meowing at me thing.
A creature I do not associate with putrefaction and decay. A creature I associate positive feelings.
She's so positive. Positive.
But we tend to really think of bugs as like this gross, visceral thing. And a lot of that is classist because there are plenty of indigenous people that have made unnecessary gains by eating bugs. There are different cultures that view bugs in a very, very different way. There's a lot of beauty in some bugs. So there is like this inherent classist objectification to it. I think it's also interesting to mention that like the kind of bug that he is never really described.
Yes.
It's that he's, correct. Yeah, it's that he's like a beetle or something. And beetles probably, I guess, like have the most neutral visage. They're just a weird thing that exists. So, I mean, you could probably imagine him as cute or as terrifying as you'd like, because beetle is a broad term. He could be one of those cool ass scarabs. You know, we don't know, but we don't know. We can be a cool bug.
Now I want to get like a bug expert to be like, these are the things. He wouldn't eat milk, but he would eat rotten food.
So, okay. So he's a detritus leafage eater. I mean, rhinoceros makes sense. Stag makes sense. Scarab, probably not. Jewel, maybe. I only know this because of CSI.
I was going to say, if he was a scarab, then maybe he would eat his dad. And that would be a better...
This thing. Isn't the mummy. They don't eat people, Victoria. Scarabs don't eat people. This isn't the mummy. This isn't the mummy. Okay, we need to talk about ennui and malaise. Because, oh boy, there sure is a whole lot of I hate my life in this. And it's valid. Like, I feel like, especially nowadays, we treat these things as if they aren't valid, but like it's incredibly valid to like not care and to just feel overburdened by everything. You know, we made a reference to Sad Beige, which is a Werner Herzog thing, and Werner Herzog just makes everything so sad. Have I told you about the deranged penguins?
No.
So Werner Herzog did this like documentary out in the Arctic, and he's talking about these penguins. They're my favorite penguins. They're Adélie penguins, because Adélie penguins are this one of the smallest penguins, and they're ready to fight God. I relate to these penguins. so he's talking about these penguins, and he says, sometimes there are these penguins that just like go fucking postal, and they start they leave the colony and wander towards the mountains. To their death, because that's not where they're supposed to be. They're not supposed to be going towards the mountains. And especially they're supposed to be doing it by themselves. And he calls them deranged penguins. And he said, you know, even our crew tried to intervene sometimes because they felt really bad. And you can turn them around and they'll go right back. Science hasn't figured out why some of these penguins have a fucking death wish. And just some days are called to the mountains and called to their eternal demise. We don't know why these penguins do that. But sometimes penguins do that. Which is just deeply sad to me.
And I'm like, and to counter this, have you ever heard the Werner Herzog thing where they were talking to him about the Kardashians and him watching the Kardashians?
Yeah, that is also Werner Herzog just talking about like, so like there's this woman on TikTok who does like Sad Beige and like her, she like makes, it's a parody of Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog knows about her. And he thinks that she's quite funny.
He contains multitudes. I would like to see the baby.
I would like to see the baby. Oh, Werner
Which
Herzog.
We still do. Do, 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 with a cat.
Werner Herzog, not listening to this podcast, but.
No, definitely not.
I can't imagine. Werner Herzog is one of those people. Like, what do you think he does for fun? What? Like, I can't imagine a leisure activity for Werner Herzog.
I would like to think that he just goes on these long walks where he just stares at the sky and screams.
I can see that. But there's a lot of ennui and malaise trapped in poor Gregor. And you get that a lot in, like, these hyper-capitalistic societies. It's why a lot of millennials and Gen Z has it. And why we look at Gen Alpha and ask, why can't you read? And we look at Gen Alpha and ask, what the fuck is Skibbity Toilet and why can't you read?
What the fuck is a Skibbity Toilet?
So there's a song on TikTok called Skibbity Bop. You've heard it on TikTok. It's that one with the large Turkish guy. You have heard Skibbity Bop. So kids have taken the software that was used in Team Fortress 2 to make these really almost like anti-Dada videos of like heads popping out of toilets singing that song. And there's lore. There's almost 100 parts to the original Skibbity Toilet saga. So now they're children who will like sit in buckets and like try to like pantomime Skibbity Toilet. I am on the internet too much and I hate what I see. I mean, I understand a lot of Gen Z memes because they're just recycling 90s culture. So I get it. Gen Alpha's memes, what the fuck are y'all doing? Like, I used to be mildly concerned about Gen Z, but now that I see that they're just diet millennial, I'm okay. Gen Alpha, the world is doomed. Civilization ends here. We're done.
Mark and I were talking about this earlier today about how basically every culture now, every generation is like, we're fucked, we're dead, it's over. Yeah. And I mean, we have legitimate documentation about how we are moving towards extinction as a people. But it's very, very fun to sit there and be like, mm-hmm. World War One, they thought the world was over. World War Two, they thought the world was over. He goes, oh, like Korea, Vietnam, I'm like Cambodia, Laos, mm-hmm. anytime Kissinger hung out. It's just this constant realization that we always think that we are two steps away from the apocalypse.
I don't know, and Tori, when you finally watch Skibbity Toilet, you might agree with me.
My entire TikTok feed right now is almost entirely Baldur's Gate memes, and I regret nothing. Oh, Good Omens too.
My TikTok right now is the Nutcracker, because that's one of my many special interests. And I keep getting David Tennant stuff.
That's probably my fault. I'm sorry.
Because I send it to you. and then I'll get the occasional Baldur's Gate, because again, I'll send it to Tori. But like, I don't have any context for this, but I do quite like Gustarion. I know Astarion is not your favorite character, but I like Gustarion very much. That is a couple of my favorite things.
I've come to terms with Astarion. I quite enjoy him, but not.
Oh, he's, now he's you not, like him.
He's not my romance. He's not my romance.
But he's your gay best friend. Got it.
He's my gay best friend. He. Right. I feel a kinship with him and his behaviors now. But valid. We're not dating. We would never be dating now. Karlach.
Okay.
Karlach and Gale are chief. Although I'm trying to romance Will right now, so I'll follow up with you on that another time.
I look forward to it. Desperately trying to maintain a routine because capitalism is a beast that's going to consume us all.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, consume us all. Tori got to learn about the brilliant phrase called a functional freeze, where you are going through all the... It felt horribly called out.
Rude.
Where you are going through the motions, you are on autopilot, but you ever just sit for too long after a shower in your towel, naked and prone, and just disassociate for too long?
Mm-hmm.
That's a functional freeze. That is an overdevelopment of one of, I think it's the somatic nerve, which is pretty much tied to when you are always anxious because there has been a trauma. I think it's the vagus nerve or the somatic nerve. It's one of the fucking nerves that controls your entire life and is fucked up because you've been through shit. So there's this like horribly Sisyphean thing of like Gregor waking up as this giant bug, and his first I was like, oh fuck, I gotta go to work. Because we've all been there.
He mentions constantly, he's looking at the time over and over and over and over again. Like, I gotta do something, I gotta do something, I gotta do something, and he can't.
Right. Like it's, and I feel like especially, you know, again, like if you go to like that chronic illness, mental illness read, I know like when I am so deep into my depression, sometimes I just have, if I can do the one thing, if I can go to work, if I can take a shower, if I can do this, and it's exhausting. but I need to do it. If I don't do it, nothing else is happening. If I don't get out of bed right now, I am not getting up. That train is leaving. And yeah, that was
literally.
Finding quote unquote freedom once you no longer have to work or contribute to society. So there is a very, very brief period where Gregor's just kind of vibing. And like, there's, again, there's something that's kind of cool in that. That like, for a minute, he's just like, oh, well, I don't have to work now. I just live a simpler life as a bug. It doesn't last long because of other factors. But there's a brief chill moment where he's just like, oh, yes, this is my new bug life.
Climbing walls, listening to music.
Enjoying some rotten food. Yeah. Okay. Do we want to talk about what being Kafka-esque means now, or do we want to get... Okay, so Kafka-esque exists in the same way that, like, something is Machiavellian or Orwellian. But the problem with Kafka-esque is that it isn't just having a routine and hating your job. I feel like a lot, like, with most of those things, it gets really, really oversimplified. Orwellian is not just surveillance, like the existence of surveillance. It is a type of thought control, manipulation, gaslighting, and hyper-surveillance. Machiavellian isn't just that one guy you met on Bumble is a dick.
I mean, right, but...
Yeah. But that's not... He's not Machiavellian.
Was this the guy in the robe?
The dude in the robe? Yeah. I didn't match with him.
So I will say,
yes.
Amanda sends me some top tier screenshots.
I do.
Of people, and I've determined that if Mark ever passes away, I'm never dating again. I'm done. I'm going to go live in the mountains or something.
Yeah.
My one friend is always joking that I'm welcome on her commune. And I'm like, that sounds delightful.
Yeah. There was the dude wearing a lot of personal protective gear that said, cookies are my second favorite thing to eat in bed. There was the dude in a robe who's a salesman. Doing what? A hooped salesman. And I think there was another one that I sent you, wasn't there? I think there was three. I don't remember. Oh, I did send you the villain Prada show.
You did.
Which was Tim Roth, Gary Oldman, Adrian Brody, and Willem Dafoe.
All they needed was Moss, and it would have been perfect.
They needed Moss, and they needed Alfred Molina.
Oh, yeah.
But then, like, there'd be too much energy, and there'd be, like, too much sexual energy in that room, and it would just combust. Oh man, they had Mads and Alfred Molina. Ugh, I just, yeah, there's a 2012 Prada show that, like, got all your favorite villains together and they all look hot. Gary Oldman's there. Okay, so being Kafka-esque usually means bureaucracy almost to an absurdist level. You having to fill out a paperwork at a doctor's office is not Kafka-esque. The redundant proving of yourself that you have to do when you are transgender and you update your documentation to reflect your gender identity. That is Kafka-esque. But like having to go to the DMV is not Kafka-esque. Your minuscule bureaucratic moments are not Kafka-esque. It's bureaucracy taken to an absurdist level that is nonsensical.
There's actually in one of his other books, there is a part where this guy finds out that the punishment for this crime is basically this machine that just carves it into your like the words of your crime into your body until you die. And I laugh because every time I read that one part in Harry Potter with him, I will not tell lies, and the lines are getting carved into his hand. I'm like, who stole that from Kafka?
You know, J.K. Rowling hasn't had an original thought in her entire life.
I have no notes.
She hasn't had an original thought in her entire life. That actually leads us into an excellent point that this, like much of Kafka's work, is not just a cry for help, but it's an absurdist tragicomedy. So there are parts of it where it is funny. You are meant to laugh. There is something that is immediately disarming and hilarious about a dude becoming a giant bug.
And immediately thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be late for work.
Like, it is truly an absurdist tragicomedy. And I feel like because the rest of the book is such a downer, it almost feels wrong to laugh in places. And I feel like just on a whole, people don't tend to think of like classic literature, I used air quotes, as something that can have comedy. And sometimes it's because we don't get it. Like, I do love when like English teachers are like, oh, Shakespeare is hilarious. Okay, but the average reader, it isn't. Like, it is to us because we're nerds. Okay, but we're nerds, Tori.
Yeah.
Like, we're nerds. We can look at Baz Luhrmann's Romeo plus Juliet and see it for the masterpiece that it is.
It is a masterpiece. And I feel like John Leguizamo does not get enough credit for that.
John Leguizamo is like...
the best Malvolio ever. Not Malvolio. I'm thinking something else. Mercutio. Thank you, Mercutio. Malvolio is Twelfth Night.
Yeah. Conflating your Shakespeare. But like... Yeah, we're nerds. It's funny to us, but like, if I was like a normal student, no, Shakespeare is not funny. No, Othello is not funny. Romeo and Juliet's not funny. None of this shit's funny. It's not Dane Cook.
Dane Cook is not funny.
You know what? I did go through a phase where I thought he was funny.
Listen, we all went through a phase where we thought Dane Cook was funny.
In hindsight, he was just loud. No, but I do like Trevor Wallace.
Okay. I had to like sit there and go,
No, I don't like Matt Rife. I used to think that Daniel Tosh was funny, and then I realized that I don't. Daniel Tosh, though, to this day still has one joke that I think always makes me laugh. So for those of you who don't know what Tosh.0 is, it was like an internet clip show, sort of like Ridiculousness with Rob Dyrdek. But with an actual comedian and not a skateboarder who is the physical embodiment of a brand sponsorship. Rob Dyrdek is the physical embodiment of sponsored content. You can tell that to his face, and I don't think he'd disagree with you.
I don't honestly know who that is, so.
Your life is better for it. So Daniel Tosh had this little show where like he'd play internet clips and make a comment. So there was one he was reviewing. It was a passion play, a play usually done by churches about the crucifixion and like the stations of the cross. And I've been in passion plays. They're usually like all day affairs. And there's always like one guy who's way too eager to like be like fake whipping someone else. Like there's always one guy who's way too into it.
And one person who's way into being Jesus.
Yeah, and one person who's way too into being Jesus. So there is this passion play. And Jesus is being crucified. Fun fact, we're not in the Philippines. We don't actually crucify people. It's usually like the thinnest Velcro. So this guy like gets propped up on the cross and he's hanging there for like 3 seconds and he falls because you're usually tied pretty loosely. And Daniel Tosh, without missing a beat, "You're free, Jesus." And I don't know if it was just all the Catholic guilt or whatever, but I thought that was the funniest fucking joke. But there's something that is so absurd and like capital A absurd, not whatever dipshit thinks that Rick and Morty is deep and smart absurd. I'm talking capital A absurdist. In tragicomedy, there is a lot of funny stuff to it. It helps, I think, when you are also deeply mentally ill because you can relate. But yeah, I imagine if I'm a normal reader, this is just a sad bug book.
Just you're like, why is this bug man so upset?
Yeah, what's wrong with this bug man? All right. Do we want to talk about Kafka's very, very sad life? Yeah. Or do we want to talk about the memes?
Let's talk about the memes first.
Okay. So here's one thing. Yeah, Tori's actually wearing a Metamorphosis shirt
that has a large bug on it that says, "I woke up like this."
Kafka. Yes.
I've had this for several years, and I love any excuse to wear it. So.
Love this for you. So one thing that millennials especially have done is taken this story and made it a meme, and one that is almost revelatory. Like, my favorites are the ones that are like, oh shit, I'm a bug, and like the next panel is the bug flying out the window. Because one of the big things that especially millennials and Gen Z are starting to get is understanding that we have to keep feeding into this capitalist hellscape, and anything that can release us is beneficial. It's why, and I will admit this is also a cry for help, so many millennials often joke about wanting to die, or at least make passive suicide ideation jokes. Because anything that can remove us from the system, because we know we can't do it on our own, there is nothing short of a solar flare or nuclear war that is going to release us from the system. The rapture could start this weekend, and Tori and I would still have to go to work.
That's been a big joke lately of like, well, you know, a hellscape hole opened in the middle of the freeway, so I'm sorry, I had to find another way around.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things I love about this is only this reclamation of the story. There's an optimism to it because it's being able to find samsara. It's a release from the cycle. It's we're no longer a part of this. And there is a deeply anti-capitalist read to it. There's a deeply, you know, anti-patriarchal read to it. There's also a lot of fun memes about like waking up as other things. My favorite is the one where it's a crab smoking a cigarette, because a crab smoking a cigarette is just me.
I love the one where the guy opens the door. Are you winning, son?
I love that one. That one is also very good. But there are so many great memes, and like, yeah, like it really is like this reclamation of, oh, hey, here's this story that was horrible. And yeah, so I shared it with Tori, and it was like, as Gregor Samsa woke up one morning from an uneasy dream, he found himself transformed into a giant, transformed his bed into a giant insect. It's like, fuck yes, it flies out the window. Cause you're free. You did
be free,
it,
my friend. Be free.
Yeah, and there's something that's beautiful about that. It's like, I kind of love. I mean, there's a lot to unpack here because, like, yeah, millennials and Gen Z, like late Gen Z, we love anything. Have you seen the TikTok of it's what would you do if you went to bed knowing you wouldn't wake up tomorrow? And it's this dude who's like, it's just like coming to bed, just like cackling, like, yes, finally. Like, we make a lot of jokes about that yes, are a cry for help. I am not here to diminish that we all have a lot going on. But it's because we're also painfully aware that we can't break this system on our own. And that the only way to fight it is to exit that system. You're seeing that a lot right now with student loan repayment, where people are saying, well, the only thing it can really affect is my credit. Never going to own a home. Bye. And it's refusing to feed into that cycle. So I find the memes fascinating. I don't think Kafka would like them.
I think it would just add to his depression.
Yeah, I think there's a part of me that hopes that he would laugh in the way that we do. But I mean, I don't think that he would. Speaking of, would you like to talk about this very, very sad man?
Yeah. So he was born in Prague on July 3rd, 1883, which makes him a Cancer.
I was going to say, that makes him a Cancer. That explains everything. He is a July Cancer like me.
One of the heartbreaking things is his dad was this bombastic dude who leaned,
asshole,
leaned hard into the German. They were Jewish, so there were already a lot of bars to entering society.
Yep.
And so he's like, I'm going to have this son who is going to be so fucking strong and everybody's going to love him. And then he had this sweet little sickly boy. So they were a middle-class family, Czech Jewish family. His mother was way more educated than his father was, which didn't help her to stop being a doormat. I have seen a lot of people put the blame squarely on her shoulders, which pisses me off because I'm like, if he's being abusive to his son, there's a big chance he's being abusive to his wife.
Yeah. I think that's important to mention. Cause yeah, like, there's a School of Life video that I have in resources. Something that's like, his mother, a doormat. And like, I get where School of Life is coming from. But at the same time, like, yeah, like, okay, if the dad was abusive to his son, pretty sure that means that even if he wasn't abusive towards his wife, the threat was there.
And where the fuck was she going to go in 1880s?
Right. So, like, not an excuse, but I feel like it's missing a lot of context.
So there are a lot of really horrifying stories. So, I mean, I feel like we probably should have trigger warning at the beginning of, like, about abuse. But, I mean, if you listen to our podcast, you've already heard a lot of other stuff. So his dad ran a really popular shop. He ran into the higher ranks of German society. And he absolutely terrorized his son. There is a story that one night Franz asked for a glass of water. And his dad, instead of getting him a glass of water or, you know, telling his son to go get it himself, picked his son up out of bed, carried him outside, and left him outside on the balcony to basically start freezing.
He was alone in his nightshirt.
And he did it because he didn't want his kid to ask him for anything.
I mean, and congratulations. Mission accomplished. I am never asking for anything ever again.
The really frustrating thing, too, is that his dad liked to insert himself into Franz's life all the time. So when he was going to school, he was absolutely in love with the written word and was like, I want to be a writer. And his dad's like, you're going to be a fucking lawyer. Mm-hmm. And so he studied to be a lawyer. He worked a bunch of jobs as a clerk where he wasn't getting paid because it was going to give him experience. And he was like, when I get experience, I'm going to bail out and I'm not going to live here anymore. My dad has no control over me. That didn't work out. And so he ended up working for an insurance company for most of the rest of his life, which if you've ever worked with an insurance company or in an insurance company, you know that it's not great. So
it's the only time
he had to write was like late at night, early in the morning. He eventually got a schedule where he would tend to work in the morning, take a short nap, and then write through the evening. But he was not comfortable with his own writing skill. He thought he was a terrible writer. He was incredibly prolific, but didn't finish most of his work. His three novels, none of them were finished when he passed away. Supposedly burned about 90% of the work that he created due to self-doubt. He told, and we'll go into this a little bit more, but he told his best friend, Max Brod, when I die, I want you to burn everything I've ever written. I don't want this getting out there. He was also a very dedicated letter writer, which is how he ended up being in very intense relationships with people he barely met. And at one point in time, he wrote a 47-page letter to his father to tell his dad what a dick he was and how they could, you know, fix their relationship if his dad would stop being an asshole, but it never actually made it to his dad. And I've heard two different versions of the story, one that he never posted it, and two that he gave it to his mom, and his mom read it and refused to give it to the dad.
I've heard the his mom never gave it to his dad story. I have some dubious feelings about that one, just because, again, a lot of people do tend to try to scapegoat his mom, like she was just as culpable, and yeah, like not giving the context, like, it was literally a different time. What the fuck did you expect her to do?
Yeah, she's willingly, like, if this was the actual thing, if she was willingly going to be like, here's 47 pages about how you're a douchebag, feel free to hit me later. Like, she's not going to give that to somebody if that's the case.
Right.
And at least I would hope not.
Right. And also, like, I can't imagine that situation going, yeah, like, that's like, that situation's not going well for anyone. So, yeah, I've heard that a couple of different ways as well. So
so very few of his works were published during his life, and they were usually in literary magazines. There was a very tight-knit circle in Czechoslovakia at the time of people who were into literature, so really only like a handful of people would have read his work at the time. And so, and there were people he was close to would be like, ah, good story, how's the insurance business? Like, it's very similar to a lot of my friends who are indie writers right now, who are like, hey, I just published my book. Anyhow, so I got work on Monday. What do you, want to like get drinks in like 3 months? Like, he was a serial proposer. He was engaged at least twice. He wanted to be engaged a third time, but his father ruined that. His father ruined a lot of his relationships.
His father ruined a lot of things. End of sentence.
End of sentence. There, one of the women that he was very in love with, the first one I think he proposed to, he met at a party for a very brief period of time. And what I think is hilarious is all the descriptions he wrote of her weren't exactly complimentary. Like, the
That's
way he was
to me.
I was like, okay, buddy. They really only saw each other for very short periods of time. Mm-hmm. She would be like, hey, do you want to hang out? And he'd be like, oh, I gotta write, or I can't. Like, the most amount of time that they spent together was at their engagement party, and he was miserable the entire time.
Yeah, that, he's so mentally ill. Just
there are a lot of critics who say that he had probably convinced himself that he should be alone. And mm-hmm. so he would have these moments where he's like, oh, I like being around people. No, but I need to be alone. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is very, ties in pretty severely with major anxiety disorders. I can attest.
Yeah, same.
So probably the worst thing, he got laryngeal tuberculosis. Thank you. So it is an extremely painful form of tuberculosis. Yes. It makes it almost impossible to eat because everything you swallow hurts like hell. Mm-hmm. So he, you know, would go to sanatoriums. He would like take time away. He would do what he could, but his body was failing him. He ended mm-hmm. up writing a short story called The Hunger Artist about somebody who just, you know, is starving themselves for the people and eventually passes mm-hmm. away and is replaced with a tiger or a
panther,
jaguar or something. Panther. There you go. Mm-hmm. So he died at the age of 40. He was in relative obscurity, broke mm-hmm. and starving because he couldn't really eat. Mm-hmm. His girlfriend at the time was taking care of him, and they were so broke that they were basically cooking over candles.
Yeah.
So what he could eat was probably extremely lukewarm.
Yeah. It's so sad.
Yeah, there's not really a whole lot of bright spots. I love this one guy who was talking about his life mm-hmm. was going, there's not going to be a part where he rises to the occasion and things get better. And it was like, well.
It sort of reminds me, do you remember the day that I told you, like, do you ever just think about Vincent Van Gogh's last words? And you were like, Amanda, what were his last words? And I told you, and you were just like.
I was like, is this a cry for help?
Right, like, damn it. For those of you that don't know, Vincent Van Gogh, who may have been accidentally shot by someone else and not attempted suicide or committed suicide, there are theories that it was an accidental homicide.
Hmm.
Yeah. But upon his deathbed, he said in French, the sadness will last forever. And I remember mentioning to Tori, like, do you ever just think about Vincent Van Gogh's final words? And Tori's like, is this a cry for help? Are you okay?
I'll dial 9-1. And if you shout, I'll dial 1 again.
Yeah. I'm going to put in 9-1. If you go idle for longer than 10 minutes, I'm hitting another one. If I don't hear from you in 0.5 seconds, press
it. Talked a little bit about Max Brod being his best friend. Now, Max Brod was a known liar, which I think is hilarious. Like, that was one of the defining factors. I'll do this. Just kidding. I won't. His justification for some things was fascinating. So mm-hmm. he was really, really close with Kafka. Kafka made him his literary executor. And by that, he meant, like, basically clear my browser history. Take all of my writing, burn it. I don't want it getting out into the world. And that included his books, America, The Trial, and The Castle, all which are mm-hmm. incredible, but weren't completed. Like, he would get to the last chapter, put it in the back of the drawer, and never touch it again, which I can understand as a writer, where you're like, this is terrible. What the fuck am I doing?
Yeah, sounds like most of the fanfic I've ever written.
Right? Lives there. I've just finally reached the point where I put things on Archive of Our Own, or AO3, if we're being legit.
I love it
so much. Anytime somebody gives me a little like kudos, I'm like, oh my God, someone read it. Anyway, so Max Brod had them published, which I think is hilarious because his justification was Kafka knew I was a liar.
Mood.
He said if he really wanted him to destroy it, he would have given them to his mother mm-hmm. or to another family member or to his girlfriend, and he gave them to me.
I mean, that's kind of valid though. Like, he kind of had to know, right? Like, that's kind of, like, huh, that's interesting. I mean, it's easy to say all that stuff in hindsight now, but, you know.
So his work didn't really become popular. I mean, it started to become popular in Europe once things had kind of died down a little bit from the world wars. And people were like, this is really good. It sucks that he's dead because we could have had more. And American publishers started hearing all this stuff from the European publishers, and they started getting a little bit jealous. They're like, so what is this that you guys are talking about, this Kafka? And they started publishing it in the US, which became really popular in the 60s, just kind of that weird, which we now say Kafka-esque, feeling of like, things aren't exactly stable. This rings true. Making him actually now one of the most famous writers in Europe, like of European descent, which is hilarious because we don't really remember his dad other than anything as an abusive asshole, but we remember Franz Kafka as a genius.
Yeah. And I think that like that's sort of the, you know, pardon the term, but poetic justice that I think sometimes is necessary. I also just think, you know, I think a lot about lost potential. There's this series that Vice does called Resolved. And they talk about like celebrities that died under like dubious circumstances. It talks about like, a lot of the conspiracy theories around it. And I just feel like for so many of the stories that they talk about, just the immense lost potential that we have that these people are gone. Like, I feel like that's sort of how I feel about Kafka. Not as strongly as I probably do for other authors, because most of his stuff just seriously bums me out, which I mean, but I do feel like this deep, like, wow, I wish that he hadn't burned everything. While also in the same breath, understanding the thought processes that lead to that stuff. So yeah, we have a bunch of resources that I'm sure you all will enjoy very much. Including, I'll go ahead and include this Wikipedia article about the death of Vincent van Gogh, because it is very, very fascinating to think that Van Gogh did not kill himself. There was also, if I recall, a BuzzFeed Unsolved episode where they talk about the death of Van Gogh, because I think that's fascinating. Those are things that I like because I am a nerd.
Gotta find joy, man. Gotta find joy.
You gotta find joy wherever you can find it. I mean, sometimes the world's just kind of on fire and you gotta find the joy wherever you can. But yeah, I had a lovely time talking about this very, very sad man.
I like that this is what I chose for my birthday month.
This is what you chose for your birthday, and for a while I tried not to judge you.
So did you have to read this in school?
I've never had to read this. And while I can't say that I didn't like it, that I didn't hate it, my life was richer before this. This is just such a sad read. And it's such his life is so sad.
I read it freshman year of college in a lit course. And we also read bits and pieces from the trial, which is even more bonkers.
It's like, yeah, I've heard.
Yeah, all of his stuff kind of has the same vibe.
Yeah, I've figured that stuff out, that a lot of his stuff has very much like the same vibe. Tori, do you want to tell the listeners at home what we're covering next month? Our first book of the new year, and this is what we choose.
And you guys get to deal with me losing my shit over Amy being awful. Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which my eighth grade teacher made me read against my will. And now I'm bringing it to y'all.
And now she's going to make it everyone's problem because I actually...
Mr. Clister, I don't even think you're on this planet anymore, but...
He's probably super dead, dude.
He made me read this and he made me read Last of the Mohicans.
So, Tori has decided she's going to make that everyone's problem now. And, it's gonna be some good content, but I can't say that I'm thrilled.
I'm gonna go watch the Greta Gerwig movie.
You can find us on most places of the social internet. Sorry, I have a gnat in my apartment and it is driving me up the wall. You can find us on Facebook, where Tori's doing a great job of posting, and I will probably be posting more. Twitter, we need to talk about that. I don't like Twitter anymore. So if there is a place you would like for us to be that isn't Twitter, whether it's Blue Sky or Threads, let us know. because I already had to do Twitter for my other show, and I can barely stand that. So if there is a place you'd like for us to move, please let us know so you can save Amanda from Twitter. It's like those old timey commercials where, like, for a few cents a day, you can save this starving village. For a few moments of time that you comment to let us know where we can leave to, you can free Amanda from Twitter.
I just heard the freaking In the Arms of the Angels, Sarah McLachlan music in the background. And yes, that's where we are right now.
Because I'll fully admit it, I am not as active on Twitter as I used to be. And because every time I log in, I just, it's just internal screaming.
So something that's really funny, one, I'm obsessed with Tumblr again. I don't want to talk about it. We don't have a Tumblr for the show. Maybe we should.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that Fangirl Nation, the only platform that WordPress has regularly been sending updates to, because Twitter won't access it anymore,
is Tumblr. Facebook
doesn't do it automatically, but Tumblr has never let me down. Tumblr has shared every article I've ever posted for the past 10 years. And I'm like, yeah, you're the real MVP. Please don't.
I wouldn't mind Tumblr, because I use Tumblr for my other show as well. So whatever, I mean, Tori and I obviously will discuss this as well. But if there is a place that you guys think that is a better home, I like the way Threads looks. Tumblr is a place that I'm already at. Let us know. But I would love to move us away from Twitter, because every time I open it, there's just a lot of internal screaming and it stresses me out. And of course, our website.
Fortuna from Karina Barana or whatever it is. Like, do you just hear, oh, Fortuna in your head? The do, 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 do.
It's a little sadder and a lot more modern. It's more like a Hello Darkness, My Old Friend kind of thing. Like, it's not as dramatic and fun and bombastic as, like, anything like that. It's not like Lacrimosa. It's just, it's like Sad World, or Mad World, sorry, Mad World. Sad World, the world that I live in where I have to work on Twitter on a daily basis. Yeah, it's more like Mad World or Hello Darkness, My Old Friend. Yeah, it's more like that. And of course, our website is a great place to find all of that stuff, including our resources. If you'd like to suggest a book for the show, or have a funny story about your English class, or just literature in general, you may do so at unfortunatelyrequiredreading@gmail.com. One of us will eventually answer your email.
Also, if you go to our official website, you will find our Redbubble store. So if you're looking for some last minute gifts, they probably won't arrive on time. But if you need stickers, if you need inappropriate stickers, yes, or if you want Amanda to make a candle salad sticker, which I think may have been in the works.
I'm working on it. I have the file open. I'm working on it. I have rendered a candle salad.
I love the fact that the white tier sticker is still our number one bestseller.
Because it's the best thing I've ever made. It's been one hell of a year. Thank you guys so much for being here with us. Stay safe out there. And if a horse skull with glass baubles for eyes knocks upon your door and asks you for some alcohol and to do a little song and dance, go ahead and let him in. Do I need to explain that reference?
I was like, I know you're talking about Mary Lloyd, but part of me is like, unless you're in particular areas of the world, that might not be a great idea.
Okay, yeah, that's true. Never, unless you are in certain parts of the world. Yeah, if a random person in the middle of Arizona does that, don't let them in. That's a whole ass Wendigo. Never mind.
I made a Texas version of the Mary Lloyd. It is a deer skull. And then perfect. I put a sheet over my head and was walking around the living room. My husband's like, please stop.
It was literally like the best thing I'd ever seen. I just got a pin for that. It has little jingle bells on it. I'm very excited. And my crow pin bag that is the most Amanda purchase that has ever existed.
I'm so excited for you to get that in. Did you actually get it in, or?
Oh, it's here.
Oh, okay. So the pictures you sent.
Yeah, that's in my apartment. It's here. The only thing I'm waiting on is I got a little insert for it that makes it a magpie.
Okay, that's what you were waiting on. Okay,
so that arrives on Monday. So I'm excited. But thank you guys for listening for a whole year. I cannot believe it is almost the end of 2023. Time is a flat circle and is utterly made up.
Yep.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in January. Have a happy holidays and stay safe out there, everyone. Bye.
Bye.